Welcome to podcast something something something. This is not an episode we can number at this point, but I'll tell you why that is. The episode is called, however, Over the Rainbow, Under the Skirt. And that is not my poetry or anything, that's the movie title. But this is yet another podcast on fire from the backlog we recorded for the purpose of putting up when a crew couldn't gather to record this week's podcast on fire, and we'd like to give you weekly fresh content if we can. So me, that is Kenny B, is here along with Hongkong Dave.
Hi.
And seeing as me and Hongkong Dave started during episode 127 to review what's kind of known as the Banana Ripening series, a trilogy of movies about a character growing up. We started that in episode 127. The review was Yes to You, Yes to Me, Yesterday, Hong Kong's The Wonder Years, if you will. We decided to sit through all three movies and do a complete coverage. So we thought we'd do that for one of the backlogs. So tonight it's the sequel to Yes to You, Yes to Me, Yesterday, and it's called Over the Rainbow, Under the Skirt. And this time it's writer-director Yo Ma that takes over to further the adventures of actor John Tang's Bo, or Bobby, or Valentino, if you will. But we'll talk about that more. Some contact information. You are listening to Podcast on Fire on the Podcast on Fire Network. The website for all of the shows is podcastonfire.com. And contact information, email podcastonfire@googlemail.com. Check out the forum, kind of the archive by now. podcastonfire.com/forum, because you can't register at the moment, and it'll probably stay that way because of spam and due to people having moved on to Facebook to discuss over there, which is fine. But in the archive is the members only extra content from the past shows, hours of stuff in there, cut conversations, outtakes, and exclusive content, which is what we took that idea of exclusive content and created the bonus episodes section on the website, not the forum, but on the website. So whenever we put up bonus episodes, you can hear them exclusively on podcastonfire.com, not on iTunes, not on Stitcher, which is probably a good idea when me and the great Lord Joshua Regal start producing bonus episodes. It's a good thing that they are only on the website. They don't need to be spread further. But as I said, we are on Facebook as well. facebook.com/POF network is our site, so give us a good old like and some comment over there and interaction over there. But most people prefer to interact in the discussion group that you can reach if you type in Podcast on Fire Network in the Facebook search box, and it will pop up. And follow us on Twitter as well, twitter.com/podcastonfire. And I do my writing over at SoGoodReviews.com. Mini reviews and big reviews of Taiwanese movies, category 3 movies, and IFD, Ninja Cut and Paste, and Robo Vampire-ish movies. And I'm saying Robo Vampire this time because, you know what, people? Robo Vampire, the Filmark Cut and Paste movie, trended on Twitter a few days ago. That's huge. And I can't explain. You just have to. It's a cut and paste Filmark thing that you have to. You can't explain it. It's just big. Robo Vampire trended. So suck on that. You know, save you that. And that will be reviewed eventually by me. I will do a re-review, and it will be a video review as well over at sleazykvideo.com. And I'll be talking of that on Twitter. twitter.com/sogoodreviews. And you can subscribe to the Podcast on Fire Network on iTunes. And if you decide to do so, if you're on iTunes all the time, leave us a rating and a comment if you like the show. We would very much appreciate that. But if you don't care to fill up your device with tons of podcasts, including ours, I'm that kind of guy. I'd like to stream my podcasts. And therefore, Stitcher is the way to go. Go to stitcher.com to download the application to your computer. Or you can download it to your iPhone or iPad or Android or tablets of various kind. And that application is free. And once you're in the application, type in Podcast on Fire Network, and you can add each show individually. And since Hong Kong Dave is here, tell us about what Hong Kong Geek Guide on Facebook is.
Yeah, well, I put up listings of all the gigs that are happening in Hong Kong. I'm busy on there as always. Recently, I've been posting while I've been listening to new CD by a local band called the Bollins. They played the Hong Kong Guide concert that was put on for me when I was out there. So that's been great fun.
Was that the event where they put up a picture of you asking you to go to the bar, that mugshot of you?
No, they used, for the poster, they used a picture of me when I was about two or three.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I'm kind of scowling at the camera, so it's quite good.
Yeah, I always thought that other picture I'm talking about looked like a wanted poster, but David, therefore you look badass. So, a little break with some music. I think we're going to put in the 1st of May again, because it's Driving Force, the BG song. The 1st of May is a driving force for these three movies, and rightly so. So, see you after the break.
When I was small and Christmas trees were tall, we used to laugh while others used to play. Don't ask me why, but time has passed us by. Someone else moved in from far away.
So welcome back, and this is the review of Over the Rainbow Under the Skirt from 1994. And yeah, these backlog episodes, we obviously are skipping network updates and last movies watched, because they are more current than these shows. We don't know when they're coming out, so therefore we are slimming down the segment, so to say, and jumping straight to a review. And the plot, taken from the Love HQ film review of the film that you'll also see a link to in the show post. So, the whole gang, minus Fung Bo Bo as the mother, who is replaced by Mei Lo Kun Lan from Yester You, Yester Me, Yesterday, is back. And apparently Bo, played by John Tang again, hasn't grown up entirely. This time out, he is preparing to enter college, but not before his final year of high school yields life lessons of the bittersweet kind. Sometime between Yester You and Rainbow, Bo managed to get together with Ting Ting, again played by Ellen Low. But the two find themselves at odds, as they have to attend different schools. Being the youth that he is, Bo's attention wanders to 19-year-old HK University student Sharon, played by Eileen Tung. Got distracted. She returns the interest, and their developing relationship makes for some fine moments handled by the king of feel 100% himself, Yo Ma. That is Koso's quote there. I feel 100% is a sore subject of mine, but we'll skip that. Over the Rainbow Under the Skirt was a UFO production. We talked about Yesterday being a UFO production in field, but UFO, United Filmmakers Organization, was not yet formed at that point. But when Over the Rainbow came out, it was. And it was produced by Lee Chin Ai, the writer of the first movie, and the director of Lost and Found, that we mentioned during our initial discussion of this series. The Kelly Chan, Takeshi Kaneshiro, Michael Wong, Terminal Illness drama. And goddammit, in the 90s, Hong Kong did well with these Terminal Illness films. You know, it could have been so silly after a while, but you got Lost and Found, you got the C'est la vie, mon chéri, obviously, the key Terminal Illness movie, and just great, great stuff. C'est la vie, mon chéri is one of those movies that, it has a sufficient DVD and all, but I kind of wished it was a few notches better on DVD. It's not a super hot print. We talked off air, me and David, that they remastered Peter Chan's He's a Woman, She's a Man. And I'm hoping they're going to do something similar with C'est la vie, mon chéri, the Derek Yee film. Which I assume you've seen, David.
Yeah, I do.
And it was also produced Over the Rainbow, that is, by Peter Chan, one of the founders of UFO. And... but it's not a Lee Chin Ai script this time around. It's written and directed by Yo Ma. And this was his second movie as director. And obviously a well-known figure in the industry by now. And he has some fine movies early on in his career, in my opinion. I'm not going to go all sourpuss or anything. It's just that I like the early stuff more than his latter stuff. He's debut, Rich Man, was a fun Tommy Wong, James Wong comedy, I believe, and Shin Fuyon was in it as well. Tommy Wong and James Wong did kind of naughty comedies, you know, raunchy comedies, even Category 3 comedies, because they were, you know, on that adult level. But Rich Man is not of that kind, and it's very fun. I remember liking the Golden Girls as well, with Lau Ching-wan and Anita Yoon. I think it was set in, like, the entertainment industry in the 60s or something like that.
Yeah, sounds familiar.
And I remember Francis had a wonderful role, at least one wonderful scene, because I remember he was in a movie or a TV production within the movie that was a takeoff or a ripoff of One-Armed Swordsman. So essentially Francis played Jimmy Wang Yu in a sort of restaged version of what a One-Armed Swordsman fight akin to, you know, mixed in with the Shaw Brothers feel, it would look like. It was fun. Francis is good fun when as a comedian. I absolutely like Francis. And he also, a few years later, directed the fantastic, again, a terminal illness drama, Funeral March, with Eason Chan and Charlene Choi. And I liked that a lot because it was one of those... I didn't expect Funeral March to be so subtle. It was actually very mature, and it didn't go the cheap route in terms of its melodrama. So I really dug Funeral March. Did you see that, by any chance?
Yeah, it's been a while, but yeah. I've seen it. Yeah, it's a good one. Yeah.
But as I said, you know, I like some. I'm not too wild about approaching Joe Ma's mostly commercial output in feel, you know, because he's directed a lot of comedies, romantic comedies, like the Love Undercover movies, which I'm sure is sufficient fun, but it's not something that appeals to me beforehand, and then it's hard to approach them, you know what I mean? They did three, and I'm not too sure if he directed all three, but at least the first two, with Miriam Jung and Daniel Wu. And I also hated the first Feel 100% movie with Eakin Cheng and Sammy Chang and Eric Kott and Kristin. It's just I don't know, that was just, I didn't feel at all, you know. I went that route with my review, you know, that I felt 0%. but I did, and Eakin Cheng was you know, very annoying, and it's just bad. And they did a few more, like two or three Feel 100% movies, or variation of the theme of young adults, semi-adults, love, romance, blah, blah, blah. But he's a fantastic producer, Joe Ma, because when I got into Hong Kong movies again, I approached, because it appealed to me, with some Yip movies, Bullets Over Summer, Juliet in Love, those kind of movies. They just did, reading about them and reading about Francis M. And I discovered him via those movies, and those two were produced by Joe Ma. And subsequently, and before that even, produced Soi Chang's Love Battlefield, which is one of the, like, breakout movies for Soi Chang after being kind of stuck in the horror genre for a few movies, directing Horror Hotline, Big Head Monster, great title, and New Blood. And but then Soi Chang began being a bit more versatile, and Love Battlefield was a good example of that. Joe Ma is also listed as producer on Victim. It was him and Ringo Lam who disagreed over the ending that we discussed during our Victim review. And as well as Alan Mack's War Named Desires, tough and bloody gangster drama, pre-Infernal Affairs, again starring Frosties. So I think Joe Ma as that behind-the-scenes person, as a producer, but what are your opinions in general of Joe Ma?
Yeah, I mean, if it's one of his sort of, you know, lighter, kind of, like you're saying, commercial kind of films, once you've seen, you know, one or two, you've kind of, you know essentially what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. I actually like the first Love Undercover movie, the chemistry between Daniel Wu and Miriam Jung is actually really good in that one.
Mm-hmm.
But two and three were, you know, two was completely sort of misconceived. They had this, at this point in the story, the first one is where they're kind of getting together as a couple.
Ooh, they fall in love, what a surprise.
Yeah, kind of, you know, but she's, you know, his, like, you know, a sort of semi-gangster. She's a sort of, slightly sort of ditzy kind of cop and that. Mm. And they have some fun with that, and it kind of works. But the story in the second one, they're sort of together, and it kind of, it's taken all the sort of the fun out of it, and it's just a real kind of convoluted...
Yeah,
it's like a convoluted storyline with these old guys accidentally robbing a bank, and, it's just... The second one was poor, and the third one, at that point, Miriam Yung and Daniel Wu had bailed out.
Yeah, I think Fiona Sit was the lead of the third one. If you hold that thought, let's check who actually directed that, if it was Mr. Ma or
I think
not.
It was.
Yeah, you're right, 2006, sole director on that one, yeah. So
it's
that's
kind
it.
Of, that didn't get a particularly great reception, and sort of was... directorial output to that point had been pretty rapid. I think it dropped off somewhat after that.
Yeah, and his subsequent movie, After Love Undercover 3, Sasori, I believe they tried to remake women in prison movie, female prisoner, scorpion, something, the Japanese movie, Sasori, and I think it was not given a release in Hong Kong even, one of those movies that just played a little bit on the festival circuit and then disappeared. I don't even think it was released on home video, or at least it took a while. And fucking hell, he's listed as director of My Sassy Girl 2.
Yeah.
Some. And I nearly all out hated the Korean My Sassy Girl, but that's on wax, by the way. We did My Sassy Girl on Watch Korean Cinema. So, did you see, maybe you did it particularly latched onto the fact, oh, is it your map production? But, did you see more of those, like, more edgier, more complex movies that I mentioned, the Wilson Yip movies and what have you?
Yeah, I mean, I've, Bullets Over the Summer and Juliet Lamb are both favourites of mine. And I did pick up on his name on there, so, on the credits. So. But, yeah, it's nice to... Know that, as a producer, he's interested at least in, getting behind films that are a little bit, different from the norm. There's not too many films like either of those two.
And certainly when the material is there, it's there. It seems like Joe can, engage a gear. I'm certainly not, a lured or lured in by titles such as Summer Breeze of Love, Sound of Colors, Diva Ahe, Hidden Heroes, Three of a Kind. I saw the Louching One Michael Hoy movie.
Yeah.
And it should have been great. Obviously, Michael Hoy back in the movie again with Louching One, who did a fantastic Michael Hoy impression in Fantasia.
Yeah,
and it was such a forgettable time. Came and went and wasn't really a pleasant experience when it was there. Which is a shame. So,
I mean, he had as a director, commercial stuff, like you're saying. He had a really good run of success. Maybe striking a chord with everyone. Domestically at least, he had a very good run, and then just kind of Love Undercover 3 just seemed to be kind of that one film too many and. Mm-hmm. And then it's kind of...
Yeah, box office speaks, and I mean, Hong Kong cinema needs the box office, needed at definitely at certain times. Love Undercover came in 2002, Infernal Affairs had come out at that point, but it was at a time where box office was definitely needed, and Infernal Affairs was obviously one of the movies that really kickstarted, it came at the correct time, a right time to explode and what have you. And I'm sure Love Undercover's box office numbers were pretty great. It played for well over a month, so
I think it went at least kind of Hong Kong 10 mm-hmm. 10 million. I think the sequel went despite being pretty terrible, the first film had gotten a lot of sort of gotten a lot of good press and a lot of good sales, I think, on DVD. So, mm-hmm. The sequel was like 20 million plus, I think. So.
All right, okay, there you go.
And then, they made, word of mouth was generally, in the long term wasn't great on it. And so by the time they did the sequel, without a second sequel without the two main stars, people didn't really want to know particularly by that point. Mm.
But it's never too late. Joe Meyer is certainly not old on his way out of the industry. He's very young. There's a making of on the Laserdisc, which I don't think I recorded for you on the DVD-R, but he looks like he's 12 years old. Joe Meyer, he's very, very young. And if there's material, if it appeals to me, I'll certainly go there. I have no hatred for him. It just doesn't. It's a strain to sit down with a movie like Love Undercover, but that's possibly me just being a douche about it. But
the first one's worth looking at. It's genuinely quite fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's not sort of it's not too soppy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, certainly didn't dislike Miriam Young at the time. I remember liking her a lot in the Wilson Yip rom-com she did, Dry Wood, Fierce Fire with Lewis Kua. I remember that was really great. It was during the time when I religiously followed Wilson Yip and saw his step into commercial movies being uneven. I mean, he did Skyline Cruises, Wilson, which was... he was very vocal about the fact that... I remember seeing an interview about him where they asked, were you pleased about the actor's performances in the film? No. Very short answers, and they changed the ending as well. And
Skyline Cruises, that have Leon Lai?
Leon Lai, Shu Kei, and a monkey.
Yeah, I remember seeing it. I think I remember Leon Lai being particularly terrible.
Actually. Yeah, just flat stuff. But I like 2002, and then Dry Wood, Fierce Fire. It was just a pleasant romantic comedy, nothing else. And it takes something to perform within that genre, obviously. And therefore, I'm sure I don't know really, aside from what you told me about the rep about Love Undercover out there. But I'm too busy with other filth and crap right now that appeals to me more, which is my problem, obviously. But that's it for now. Let's go into the notes on the film, the sequel. So, in short, first, David, good or bad sequel? I guess it's a good question.
Good sequel. It perhaps doesn't quite hit the heights of the first film, but it's certainly an honourable, perhaps even decent sequel.
Yeah, it's in my opinion, it's somewhat more flimsy, but it is a good continuation about the development of Bo or Bobby or Valentino, as Bo, our main character of Bo, says his name at one point. His English name is Valentino, which kind of fails and bombs the right way. But it all continues to reflect real life lessons. We get sympathetic and highly unsympathetic behavior, but Yo Ma brings it home eventually, making it nearly good as the original. I mean, I think in particular the second half really starts to become real, and it's not like I disliked the first half, but it feels somewhat more flimsy. You're not trying to find its footing. It's not quite on the ground, Now it found its footing. I will talk about more, but I'll tell you this much as a teaser, if you will, about the moment I thought the movie really found its stride. And it's another one-on-one scene with Eric Tsang and his younger co-lead, John Tang, which are really, they're really good in the first one together, and they are here as well. But we'll go through the movie a little bit and talk of what we like and dislike. There's still narration here, as per the Wonder Years, and what I don't remember from the Wonder Years, and I didn't have time to look at some clips, was if the narrator made sort of real-life comments about real-time comments about the actions in there. For instance, if Fred Savage was about to be kissed, I don't know if the narration said, "Oh my God, I'm going to be kissed for the first time," or if it kept its distance. Lao Ching-wan's narration, because they bring in Lao Ching-wan to narrate the movie, it is reacting to the moments here, and it was true for the first film as well, that it was really Bo's mind in the moment we heard as well, as well as being a obviously it's a narration from him as a grown-up, so it's obviously it's not his kid self narrating the scenes, but it's recognizably obviously Lao Ching-wan. By now Lao Ching-wan's voice, whether it's him dubbing himself after a movie or in obviously in sync sound, you uh, you knew when going from post-dub movies to sing-sound movies that, wow, launching one dubbed himself, great. You know, it's fun to be familiar with a voice. But it opens in a fun way. I loved it. It's a shot of trees. A very long shot of trees. And it's all very quiet. Very quiet. And then launching one comes in, you know, bored. It's the first line, are you bored? And what it is apparently he's jumping ahead in time because Bo turned into a film student in the mid-80s. It is set though in like 82, 83. And the first movie was like 79. And it's footage of Bo's film Postmodern Sex Life. So what the fuck did he turn into? Not an obnoxious kid, but a pretentious kid. And he won second prize in 1985 at some during his school years or at some film festival. But he lost to Wong Jing, who made a movie. And I wrote down this title. They translated, this is all made up, obviously. They translated the winning movie as "On this bright sunny day, strange enough, our hearts are still dark like the night, but can still feel your powdered face." That's the Wong Jing movie that won. And it's all an alternate timeline, kind of, because Wong Jing had directed movies for many years in 1985. So it's just a joke. You know, Wong Jing could make in jokes in his movies. So, you know, and it's not a slam on Wong Jing, I think. It's just a silly thing to say.
Yeah.
That's a quirky start. And obviously the movie is going to be quirky on and off and heartfelt as well. And they continue that home video footage setup of the characters. So I guess my question is, did you feel there was any problem with the fact that they jump ahead in the timeline and all of a sudden, whoa, are they together now? Are Bo and Ting Ting together? What's going on? They're making out and they're about to have sex. I'm sure you didn't feel lost, but was there any issue with that jump?
No, because you kind of got the sense from the first film that, you know, there was something there that was sort of kind of unresolved. So when you got that bit in the second film, it didn't feel, you were sort of taken aback by it. They kind of laid the groundwork for that, I think, in the first film. So it wasn't, you know, even you could tell it was a big sort of jump there, but it wasn't sort of it wasn't jarring. You kind of got the sense that something might happen.
So. Mm. And he's more hormonal in this movie. Obviously, a lot of the issues, not a lot, but obviously a issue is at this point that he's a virgin. He wants that thing out of his life. He's not really desperate, but, you know, he wants to lose that. They are kind of a cute couple. They make a deal to think of each other every hour. At least he has to adhere to that deal. You know, every even hour or he has to sit down, close his eye and think about her. And he has to keep track of all their anniversaries, you know, for their first kiss, for their first time they held hands, during their when they first had their fight. You know, way too much crap for a male to keep track of. Way too much crap. I'm also thinking it's a challenge, this movie, a lot more, I think, for viewers to... Challenge, but you know, Bo is more of an unsympathetic character, this one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, he's kind of a dick. Genuinely a dick towards his friends and his parents and all of that stuff. Without spoiling anything, obviously, what do you think of that whole journey that he has to go through to learn, you know, not be a dick and treat, to be better, to be a better person, you know?
Yeah, I mean, they had the voiceover bit, and you know, he's kind of, you know, a lot of the time here he's kind of thinking one thing but he ends up saying another, and it's, you know, he don't sort of he's not kind of, you know, kind of listening to, you know, to himself. He's just got, you know, he's been like a moody teenager and so it all kind of works. I think it's sort of you know, everyone kind of goes through those kinds of times when you know, they don't do, you know, they kind of don't do what they should, you know, don't treat people like they should, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's why I like these moves a lot. These are genuine life lessons. They are familiar but not cliched, because they do echo stuff. You know, you do think back that, you know, you were kind of a prick to people. You didn't think about what you were saying, and you remember that years later that you, you know, it was not kind to. For instance, that heartbreaking scene where he... when he's playing basketball in the school, and his friend Mickey, you know, the guy with the glasses,
yeah,
he's not as good at basketball, and Bo just laughs at him, you know, just points and laughs at him with his friends, you know, that's just dickish behavior, you know, and Joe Ma thankfully doesn't play the fact that, well, you know, it's cute, he will learn later, you know, he actually just portrays him as an all-out dick and a prick and you know, insensitive and selfish, obviously.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, I mean, that is one of the good things here in this film, and in the other one as well, I guess. But it's they do it more here. The characters aren't you know, either one thing or the other. They're not either, you know, really nice, or they're not just sort of, you know, kind of completely horrible, you know, horrible people. They're kind of, you know, they mix up a bit. They're kind of flawed, you know. They don't do the right thing. They don't, you know, treat people that well necessarily. But, you know, they could, you know, you kind of go through these, you know, these experiences. You know, pick up sort of they pick up knowledge, and they, you know, they could sort of, they come through, you know, the experiences, they come out the other side as, you know, as better people. So.
Mm, exactly, because it's never too late, and this is not, you know, neat movie conventions.
No.
That it all will work out in the end. I think Joe Ma echoes reality very well in that regard. You know, it's recognizable stuff. One little bit of, in regards to the narration, I love Lao Ching-wan's narration when Bo is reacting to when he's seeing Ting Ting naked for the first time, you know, the off-screen nudity. And I think the subtitles went, oh, is that it? Not bad. And then Eric Tsang, as his father, walks in, and it turns out, you know, it's all a fantasy. He's been in there masturbating, and, you know, it's the classic, you know, parents walking in on on you, and, you know, you think you, oh, I'm, you think you conceal it well. Obviously, Eric Tsang gets it right away. And, you know, he says, it's a bit stuffy in here, I think he says as well.
I just open the door a bit. Oh, it's very stuffy. I'll open the door a bit more.
Yeah. Which is one of many wonderful Eric Tsang touches. Yeah. He's excellent in this film as well. Not being Eric Tsang to that annoying degree. And he wasn't in the first one either. He's a very, you know, well-conceived father figure, and it's as natural as anything in that role. And the family vibe is kind of nice too, because they all courteously laugh at Eric Tsang's stories and his jokes, you know, but not in a mean way or anything. You know, because they've heard it so many times, they just go along with it when they're all sitting at the dinner table, you know, to laugh courteously at your parents' joke. But they do have a shot of John Tang. There's a TV in the background where essentially someone is maniacally laughing, you know, ha, ha, ha. And you see John Tang echo that, you know, it seems like he wants to come up with a variation of laughing, you know, in a courteous manner at your parents' joke. So there's little touches of that. And nothing is truly perfect for the character, and their vision of perfect romance with Bo and Ting Ting, you know, going to school together, and they're going to be, going to be together all the time. You know, it's so... They try to set it up so conveniently, the characters, that you definitely feel that their paths are going to differ throughout the movies.
Yeah.
Which is a good story element as well, that I really liked seeing. It was expected that they were going to differ, but it was... Joe Ma kept a good through line in terms of that story. Very expected stuff, again, in this series. It's not cliched familiar stuff in a bad way. It's all expected stuff, because you do recognize it from your life, or know it's part of life, and the lessons are there to be gotten. And fun stuff can be immediately halted by tough emotional stuff as well. You know, one of the early instances of that is his best friend Mickey. explains, I think it's after a basketball game where he's laughed at him, that he explains that his parents are getting a divorce, and they have that example of Bo's narrator, his angel, if you will, saying, like, I gotta console him. And what does this immature but in development type of kid say? Well, it was like, is your dad having an affair?
Oh, yeah.
Is your mom having an affair? You know, oh, you dumb fuck. You know, not you, but John Tang's character, you know. So it seems like he gets nervous when it comes to these situations, you know, trying to say the right thing. And he doesn't have a filter. And it seems like it just comes out, and which is nice and humane, I guess. Let's go into the storyline a little bit of him and Eileen Tung, as is the love that he finds in this movie, that he's transfixed by the older student. And I mean, it's said that she's 19, I think. What age is he in this movie? Is it 15 or 16, probably?
Maybe 16, 17.
Still, clearly, you know, we're talking nearly an adult and a kid here, getting along and finding a connection. So what did you think of their story together? Sharon is Eileen's character, because it's in my mind it's kind of complex. You don't really know where it's going ultimately.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, sometimes I found it a little hard to sort of kind of go with it, because she seemed so much bigger than he was.
Yeah.
And it seems like more mature, you know, not just kind of physically, but she's like, you know, it's like, oh well, you know, she's like, you know, considerably taller than him. She looks quite a few years older than him as well. It just, you know, sort of visually at least. I mean, the performances were fine. The performances were really good, in fact, but it just visually looked a little odd, because she looks quite a bit older than he is.
Mm.
So it's slightly jarring like that, but you know, but their performances were terrific, so they kind of bought it around for me. But it was slightly that kind of contrast was a bit startling at first, you know.
Yeah, it plays into that fact that I think the movie is also somewhat flimsy but fun to follow.
Mm.
But there is a conscious design here in terms of making their, you know, them visually as a couple kind of, you know, an odd fit.
Yeah.
And he's not on her level, you know, because she's cultural, a bit pretentious, but still cultural. She reads books and she watches art film, and he does, you know, the regular dude thing of like, okay, I'm gonna impress this girl by going to an art film, and it doesn't work out as well, because he thinks they're going on a date, but she's in fact the kind of the projectionist at the art film show, so he watches it alone and tries to read books that she does, you know. But ultimately, I think. And also, he tries to catch up, by the way, with her English phrases, because he's not that good at the English. You know, he doesn't know, I think, what down to earth means. But as soon as she says Star Trek, you know, whoa, I get that. You know, so
that's the odd thing as well, because I thought the way they defined down to earth, you know, in the film, they give a definition of it as being like kind of ordinary. I've never thought of it as that it meant that.
No, not really. I mean, it's maybe his interpretation of it too. Because down to earth is definitely not dull or ordinary or plain or anything like that.
No.
So, but I did like it. I mean, it's, you know, when you're at the end of the film, you know the circle has been, you know, closed, and you get this storyline. But despite it being you know, kind of odd that they hang out, and you wonder what is their connection, you know, is there a romance here, and we should just a free spirit that doesn't really care if she kisses him deeply just to get back her cough drops, you know.
yeah
it's just a thing that she does, you know. But man, is that's obviously confusing in terms of signals.
Yeah.
And So, yeah, and then he's maybe he's about, therefore, you know, maybe he's hopeful inside that he's finally going to lose his virginity, because even his friend Mickey has lost his virginity to his cousin. There's a story. Whoa. Wow.
That relationship with Sharon, she does mention at one point that they're different people, different kinds of people, you mm-hmm. know. She talks about him and you know, Ting Ting being a good match and a good couple.
And yeah, it's probably true, you know. And they ultimately, I think they again, this is not spoiling anything, but they do realize that they're probably destined to hang out, which is not a bad thing, you know, being there for each other, just to hang out, which is, and by the second half that. Their relationship is more defined and it flows much better, as does the film. And I want to get back to the moment where the movie really hits its stride and decides to become real, right? And again, we won't spoil anything, but I want to mention a moment. Anyway, there's a, you know, during all this flimsy kind of moody schizophrenic, it positives the impression the movie kind of gives off. When Lao Qingwan talks of that he harbors some resentment towards the past lost dreams of his father. His father speaks of being a footballer when he was young, which I think is, if I remember correctly, that was what Eric Tsang did at one point as well, before entering the movie business as a stuntman and subsequently writer, director, and actor, what have you.
Yeah, I think he still kind of plays, you know, like a charity matches and that mm-hmm. kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, it's not because he's injured or anything. It's just he went where the career kind of was, I guess, and the money possibly was. And he got a gig at Shaw Brothers Studio eventually, and at late 70s, and you know, and the rest is history in terms of Eric Tsang's importance in Hong Kong cinema.
True. Yeah.
But that moment I'm leading up to, Bo is really, you know, gets down. You know, he doesn't want to go in those footsteps, to not have his dreams be unrealized, and he's kind of judgmental towards his father, you know, saying he's got nothing, you got nothing, and after the scene in the dubbing studio, which we'll get to the scene I'm getting to, but obviously the scene in the dubbing studio is worth mentioning because we got some fun cameos here. Clifton Coe, a well-known director, is in the dubbing studio, but first and foremost, Leslie Cheung has a two-scene cameo. I will talk of the second scene as himself, and dubbing one of his movies, which I think is the footage in the movie. And they refer to Rachel Lee, which leads me to believe that they are referencing firmly that he's dubbing For Your Heart Only, which doesn't fit in the timeline that came out in 85. This is a few years earlier in the movie, but you know, regardless, they didn't shoot footage that from a movie that didn't exist. I think it's actually from For Your Heart Only. And this scene, just a nerdy detail, it turns sync sound for a few moments, the scene in the dubbing studio. So possibly it was they wanted really wanted Leslie's voice in there rather than make someone else dub him, or maybe Leslie didn't have time to go in afterwards and dub it, because most of Over the Rainbow, Under the Skirt, you know, 95% of it is post-dubbed dialogue, but by the performers, by the main performers, so, which helped, including Eric Tsang, obviously. By this time, he didn't let anyone dub him, and the few times when that happened, it's really jarring. You know, that isn't Eric Tsang. You know, early movies, you know, way early movies and stuff like that. So, but the moment now I'm talking about that, I really admire. Bo gets feisty with his father about the pen that he gave his father, and Leslie took it, so to say, in an exchange during the dubbing studio. And when he kind of argues with his father, because they're walking home, and he expects the father to kind of play it off as a joke, but then his father and Eric Tsang obviously gets real. So he says to his son, "No, what do you want me to do, call the cops or anything?" And wow. You know, I like that. He's sharp. His father is really sharp. He knows that something is bugging the hell out of his son, And I got to bring him down to earth somehow or try to interpret what's going on. You know, I can't make a joke out of this situation. You know, I got to make it real. And man, are these two performers really young and veteran gelling. You know what I mean? That chemistry between them, I think, is so wonderful to have.
Yeah, and those, they had the terrific one-on-one scene in the first film as well. There's two or three sort of bits here as well. They just, as a pairing on screen, you know, just in those kind of in those one-on-one bits, they're just, you know, it's really good. It's a really good on-screen sort of pairing.
And without going loud or anything, they just play it very casually and very in a subtle way, you know.
Yeah.
And same really. I mean, I'm kind of sad to see Fung Bo Bo go. She wasn't recast for whatever reason. But Mei Luo, Luo Konglan, is, you know, gets a scene or two here where she is alone with Tang, and I think there's even a, you know, one-on-one scene with Bo and his sisters. I think it's very crucial to have these one-on-one scenes because Luo Konglan has a scene where she comforts Bo after rejection, if you will, and you know, that age-old rejection that you face as a youth. And she, you know, there's two in a frame, you know, just talk, just real. You know what I mean? No fancy anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah, just you know, very, very realistic. You know, straight and, you know, to the point.
And direct. I was kind of afraid about one thing, in particular during the first half, that they were going to overuse the 1st of May, but they don't, and they managed to make it a crucial part of the movie. I like in particular that they combine scenes and narration over 1st of May. It's not something, the 1st of May, the Bee Gees song, doesn't dominate. They keep it as part of the background, and even has an instrumental piano version of it replicated here. So it's still a theme that drives the mood of the film. So did you think it still worked to continue license the Bee Gees music?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very sort of very emotional kind of evocative song, and like I said earlier, I didn't think they quite got to the level of the first film, but they the storyline, you know, the stories that they had in there, the sort of, you know, the experiences that they were documenting, was, you know, certainly it certainly worked to have the song there again, you know. Mm-hmm. And it they used it well.
Again, we're going to talk a little bit about second half again without spoiling anything, but because I really think it's where it works well and it becomes hard to watch even, because the height of the prickish behavior by Bo is doing another school dance where he, at this point, he has a lot of resentment and fury, and it is towards Ting Ting, I can say that much. And he's reactionary, you know, it's unfiltered reaction, and he just breaks her heart, you know. He says the most heinous thing, you know, on the theme of that you mentioned earlier, that he doesn't listen to his inner voice, because he at this point he can't, I guess. Yeah. It's a difficult second half to watch, because it's just kind of heartbreak and tragedy upon heartbreak upon tragedy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Did you feel that kind of brought the movie home for you finally when it became real, if you will?
Yeah, because it played like it was a shock to him. It kind of woke him up, and there's another great scene. Where I think that him and his father, they're talking about his dreams, and you know, they're talking about the playing football, and, you know, he's sort of discussing family.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he's sort of, and you know, he brings in, you know, the fact that he was with his mother by that point, and you know, that she was pregnant with him, so you know, that was, he, you know, he kind of didn't pursue his dreams. He started the family, and you know, mm. and, And that's why, you know, so at that point there's more kind of, I guess, you know, respect of and sort of understanding of, you know, the choices that his father had made.
I think that's, it tops any scene in between those two. Again, between John Tang and Eric, that scene where he has a medical condition, if you will. I want to say that. So he's massaging his leg. John Tang is massaging his father's leg, and he says, and I thought this was so wonderful, you know, touching and wonderful, wonderfully funny at the same time, that he says, well, you'll be up and about in no time. Well, what do doctors know? They told me that your mother was expecting a girl, and then we got you. Which is, you know, that was great. And just dialogue, you know. It's not like, okay, here comes the great line. That is just, I think their back is to the camera even they're walking away.
Yeah, it's just that bit as well where I think they're talking about like choices that made, you know, what to do, you know, what he sort of choices that he made in his life. They said, I think there's a line, something like, if I had, you know, made a different decision, you know, you wouldn't be here to sort of touch my leg or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. To massage his leg, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I have to say, you smile, and you know, I was so touched by that, and it's just so simple. And you know, kudos to Joe Ma for making that moment stand out. Without, it shows some confidence, shows some maturity as director, shows some skill, obviously, great skill, to make those kind of scenes work. That's when cinema is kind of, you know, wonderful for me, when it just is, and you can get it instantly without them simplifying it for you, because you're into the story. It's definitely complex, but it's not hard to interpret those kind of moments.
No.
And the movie, you know, earns your tears, definitely. And all it is really, and not all it is, that's not a good way to say, but the theme really is to work out your differences is a key, you know. Eventually, it's okay to work out your differences, you know. You don't, if you can't apologize and realize what you've done wrong first, then eventually you should and you can. And you and your close ones and your friends, you know, go on your path and then you are friends again, you know. It's a very grown-up thing to do.
Yeah, it's always, it's kind of saying that there's always a chance to make amends, you know, if you get something wrong, you know, or you behave badly, or, you know, you make mistakes, you know, it's never too late to sort of repair the damage.
Yeah, it was the same with the kind of the ending of the first movie where he had to apologize to his mother, you know, because he'd been kind of a dick to her as well.
So,
but the only thing that was odd is that it seems like they weren't planning a sequel, a third movie, because they, at the very tail end, they tell kind of the rest of Bo's story really quickly in narration about what became of him and what became of other characters, and then the movie ends. But we still have a third movie to see, so it seems like they weren't fully planning. They were maybe planning to wrap it up, which they do rather.
It doesn't sort of, the way they handle it at the end doesn't suggest that they were at that point thinking of a third film.
Hmm.
I mean, I guess it must have done well enough that they thought, well, you know, maybe there's still some mileage here
with
the story and with the characters. So.
So that's the end of my main note. So obviously, if you can't find it, it was released on Laserdisc and VCD, but never a DVD, I believe. But the VCD was by Fitto, F-I-T-T-O, Fitto Laser, and that's the Laserdisc I have. I have the VCD actually as well, so I'm sure you can find it on the file sharing forums, if you will. And it comes recommended. Obviously, watched the first movie, Yes to You, Yes to Me, yesterday, and I hope that Megastar DVD of the first movie, which is a really good DVD, I hope that's still out there, because this never went to the Joy Sales collection or anything like that. So that's the end of my main notes. Do you have any other main notes before I go into my additional thingies?
Just a couple of little bits. In the kind of university disco scene, I love the bit where they're on the soundtrack. They've got a song that's desperately trying to sound like Footloose without being Footloose. It's sort of,
well, it is a legal production after all. They have licensed the BDS music, yeah. so they can't be every other Hong Kong movie. That's what.
Yeah, probably didn't have the budget for this one as well. But it kind of sounds. You hear little bits on the song that's all right. That's obviously what they're trying to do, but
it fits the timeline too, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It never quite gets there, but it's quite funny anyway.
Maybe they had to spend a shitload of money on the fact on 1st of May, so they couldn't afford to get another, you know, known song. Obviously, hit at the time. I mean, it was around about 1984, and not at the time, but at the time of the movie set, it's kind of correct, you know, plus 1 or 2 years or so.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about the earlier sort of half of the film. I had a note that I said, you know, initially at least, in the first half of the film, the sort of parents are given kind of a lot less to do in the film. I mean, it wasn't really quite like that in the first film. There was a bit more sort of kind of kind of back and forth there. But I mean, it's difficult to do the same thing twice. So maybe, you know, switching it up and the focus being on him, you know, his kind of it's kind of trials and difficulties. Maybe, you know, that was the switching it up and making it like that was a good move. But you know, like we've spoken about, they do, you know, the parents do have their their moments in the film as well. You know, important moments, and without giving anything away, you know, there's a, you know, there's sort of a, you know, integral part of the finish to the film.
Mm-hmm. So. And even the sister, you know, is given a few moments here. She isn't running to the bathroom like she is in the first movie. it's really earned as well. You know, they are obviously not fighting all the time, but they are in stages in their life where they, you know, they decide to be emotional towards each other, you know, to have a moment. So John Tang gets a moment with his sister as well, which is very earned and very real.
That's good scene.
Yeah, and before that scene, there's a really funny scene where Sharon has stayed the night at Bo's home. Not that they slept with each other or anything, but she stayed the night, and she wants she knows she's kind of needs to be hidden, but she can't wait. She can't hide forever, you know. She needs to use the bathroom. So while Bo is talking to his sister, you know, Sharon comes out before him, you know, taps him on the shoulder, you know, I gotta use the bathroom. and his kid's sister says that, and she gets highly emotional due to this, which we find out later why she's really involved emotionally in his love life. You know, she disapproves highly, and then you hear from inside the bathroom, which toothbrush can I use? And he just sinks his head into his arms. You know, kill me now, this is not working. I also want to talk a little bit about Leslie's second scene here, and he's in the hospital visiting a character, and there's a sequence here where, you know, it's very pleasant because for one, you know, Leslie is very warm, he's very kind, he plays himself, and obviously he's not here to play, you know, an exaggerated version of himself. You know, he's very warm and kind, and he's talking about a script that he's received, you know, a gangster script, and he's wondering if, you know, is this director any good, you know, that has written this? It's a very reputable director, Eric Tsang says, you know, because he works in the industry, he works in the as a dubbing artist, and he gives the script to Bo to, you know, can you read this? Can you give me your feedback on it? And by all accounts, it's the script for A Better Tomorrow.
Yeah, it's good that bit. I like they work that in.
Yeah, and I really like Leslie in this, you know, very, very kind, very warm, And they throw in some references here and there to real life people that were in his Bo's class. I think it's a very slight reference, but they call someone up to the desk or to go outside of the class, and they say Eric Cotmanfe, and then you see a character rise and leave the frame. So they seem to slightly just say that possibly Eric Cot was in the same class as Bo. Just one of those minor things that passes you, and but they don't call out Jian Lam, which is obviously Eric Kotze's partner in crime when they were kind of DJs and stuff like that, or characters that were DJs. It's those two that have that awful but awesome dancing singing scene in City Hunter. You know, they're the soft hard kids. And Eric Kotze obviously went on to star in You Shoot, I Shoot, and he's a fine dramatic actor. And Jian Lam was, you know, is a good actor as well. But for his best participation in the movie was as the narrator in the McDowell movies. I don't know if you knew that. That's Jian Lam narrating in McDowell. Oh, obviously not a super distinct voice or anything, but you know, I read him in the cast list, and oh, how nice! I love the narration in the McDowell movies. It's great that they have Jian Lam do that. So, going back a little bit to his relationship with Mickey, his best friend Mickey, it's he moves in. Mickey moves in after his parents are said to be divorced. You know, he has to move in with Bo, and it's you know. It's a part here in the movie where Bo is not really kind to him either. You know, he reacts in that kind of, you know, teen way, because he doesn't know any better at this point that he will be kind of gay sleeping with your friend without a shirt on, because they're going to share a bed. But he doesn't have that Mickey's clinging in his sleep. and it is a fine comedic moment here that's made in edits that where you see Bo sleep really, you know, sound and comfortable, and it turns out he's sleeping in between his parents. And Mickey got his room instead, you know, so cut to him sleeping with his parents again, you know, to get away from Mickey. And my next last notes on Sharon, you know, you get a little bit of her issues, again without spoiling anything, that she carries issues of rejection herself, you know, has failed relationships behind her, and this relationship with Bo is, it's developing into, as we said earlier, this, you know, he becomes her rock, kind of, you know, it's developing naturally into a friendship where they just sit and drink together and talk together, and I like that, and I like those, you know, small clues into her emotional state. And at the end of the movie you do find out that she you know, she has lessons to learn as well, and development too. She's 19, but she's still developing, you know. And that's all fine. And my final note, have you seen a poster image from this movie?
I may have done.
Well the poster image is of Eileen Tung leaning in to kiss what is a 6-7-year-old kid, and I found that poster rather interesting. We're gonna do slight editing point here while I show David the poster. So,
oh right, yeah, I got it. Yeah.
So this poster image is quite interesting because it's kind of controversial if you think about it. She's an adult kissing a kid in oversized clothes. He is in oversized clothes, and I think that, not in a pretentious way or anything, is representing that they are not on the same level. You know, in the movie, they are very different. They can have a connection, but that's possibly all there is going to be of that connection.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you never see him as a kid, or there's no fantasy sequence of him in oversized clothes or anything. And there's a pile on the floor of kid things, you know, baseball bat, a baseball cap, dolls, and stuff like that. So it's an interesting poster image for the film, where you go, and yeah, there you go. That's the end of my notes in total. So, do you have anything else, David?
No, I'm all done.
Alrighty. So next time, for one of the backlog shows or what have you, we will obviously conclude the trilogy, and that will be of the third movie from 1997, directed by Jacob Cheung, is Yesterday You, Yesterday Me. And Jacob is obviously a great, talented director that we should bring up more on the podcast on Fire Network. You know, anything from Cage Man, Always On My Mind, the Michael Hoy movie we talked about, The Kid, Leslie Cheung, Dick Long, Karim.
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic movie. And big budget movie as well. I have Battle of Wits here on my pile. I haven't seen that yet. The Andalau movie from 2006. I also loved Midnight Fly, the Anita Moy movie. That all I got to say about that, because it kind of will ruin the surprise if you talk about it in detail, but Midnight Fly was a punishing movie, and you didn't expect that. That could make you depressed for days. That movie, that was violent and punishing, and you didn't expect that necessarily. Got Anita Moy acting in English quite a bit in that movie, because the other main character is a Japanese girl. So there's a lot of Jacob Jung movies to recommend. Cage Man is probably one of his better movies. The category 3 rated social drama, rated for language, I believe. It's got, among other people, it's got a great cast. It's got Victor Wong from Big Trouble in Little China, one of his Hong Kong movies that he did. So it was cool to see Egg Shen from Big Trouble in Little China in a Hong Kong movie. And it's got Roy Chow and Wu Fung and Ku Feng, Liu Kashi and Taylor Robin Kwan. Just fantastic stuff, Cage Man. And out of all movies, this is all nerdy details, but out of all movies, you know, it's a very low-key movie, and they still went to town with it in terms of its soundtrack. They mixed it in Dolby Stereo or Dolby Surround, which was not common for any movie, special effects movie or drama or... you know, so they really made that movie thoroughly professional, and the only addition with that Dolby soundtrack, that Dolby Stereo soundtrack, is the Laserdisc, because it was never on the VCD, nor there was never a DVD. So that's Hong Kong cinema for you. It isn't always fair, you know. But anyway, we will conclude our coverage of the Banana Ripening series with Yesterday You, Yesterday Me at a later point. So we'll go through some contact information again, and then we'll sign off for this backup sub-bench type of show, if you will, which is not a bad thing. And as I said during one of my earlier solo chats, using this format, is that I'm happy to be on the subs bench, and I'm probably it's probably my rightful place, you know, when all is said and done. But anyway, you've been listening to Podcast on Fire on the Podcast on Fire Network. Email podcastonfire@googlemail.com. The old forum with the old members only archive, podcastonfire.com/forum. But the current exclusive content from members only is available in the bonus episodes posted on the website, only on podcastonfire.com, not on iTunes, not on Stitcher. And on Facebook, facebook.com/PUF Network, and come on in and like us, but come on in also and discuss with us in the discussion group. Type in Podcast on Fire Network in the search box. And visit us and follow us on Twitter as well, twitter.com/podcastonfire. And check out my filth and drama and Taiwanese movies and what have you, my mixture, at sogoodreviews.com. And check out the little video reviews of that mixture at sleazykvideo.com. And follow me on Twitter as well, twitter.com/sogoodreviews. And you can subscribe to the Podcast on Fire Network on iTunes. If you like the show, we would very much appreciate a rating or a comment. That would help the show a lot. And if you prefer to stream your stuff, your podcasts, your radio, you can do that on via Stitcher Radio, available to your computer from Stitcher.com, or download it from your nearest app store, from the iPhone app store, if you will, or from the Android app store, and to your tablets as well. And once you're in Stitcher, just type in Podcast on Fire Network, and you can add each show individually. And again, in general, talk about what Hong Kong Gig Guide is for those who doesn't know.
Yeah, it's just my listings of all the shows happening in Hong Kong. There's always plenty of stuff going up, pretty much each and every day. So,
and it's year round, you know, there's always events going on.
Yeah, pretty much year round. You know, some points of the year are busier than others. But yeah, there's always always something happening.
Good. And that's us. So. Thank you, everybody, for listening to this backup show of Podcast on Fire. So I've been your host, Kenny B, and with me was Hong Kong Dave.
Bye, everyone.